Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Gommans, and I'm here with our producer, Elliot Bloom.
Hello, hello.
Today, we're going to be talking about some exciting new releases that coincidentally all have a budget under $25 million. So does this mean the mid-budget movie is so back? Before we begin, I'd love to share some cool things going on in the coming weeks here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. If you want to change your outlook on life, make sure to see Edward Yang's classic Yi Yi for its 25th anniversary. Also, come join us at the next Celebrating Cinema Film Club on October 16th, where I'll be introducing one of my personal favorites, Challengers, to coincide with our upcoming episode about Desire. First up, we have a little news round because it was a big week in film news. Last week, we talked about One Battle After Another and how much we loved it. Turns out it's a bit of a flop.
Well, if you look at the numbers, yes, but I don't think that's a fair assessment. I think because it had such a big budget already, I think it's $130 million, some say maybe even $175. That means it has to do a lot of... It basically has to smash a lot of records
for it. It has to be like super mainstream.
I read that. So in total, of all the Paul Thomas Anderson films that he's made, his total grossing at the box office is something like $320 million. And that's what he needs to make.
Oh, just in total, like over all his movies?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Before One Battle After Another. And he needs to make that with just this film alone. Yes. But what's funny, if it was, say, a $90 million budget,
then it would have done fine.
Yeah, people would say it's doing really well. But I think already it's only made $22 million domestically in America. And I think to give some comparison, Sinners made double that already in its first weekend.
Yeah, which is like a similar budget, similar like unique original IP. What do you think that is? Because it's not an IP. It has a big name actor. It has several, but like it has Sean Penn and Leonardo DiCaprio. Are they just no longer the draw?
I think it's just hard to sell films based off of stars, I think. I think we're spoiled with so much, maybe, that, I don't know. I tried to think of films that will draw you to go to the cinema.
Yeah, and I think with Sinners, it has a really good like tagline. It's like, it's vampires, really. Yeah. Or like, it's blues vampires.
Yeah.
And here it's like, well, it's about this activist, but then it goes into... So I guess it is like a little bit harder to sell. I do think... Once it will get a Best Picture nomination and potentially a Best Picture win, it might get a big second wind. But yeah, for now, like for an opening weekend, it's not great.
No, but what I'm a bit confused about is what they actually spent their budget on, because...
Right. This division?
It seems like it, but it doesn't feel like a high budget film. It doesn't feel like an Avatar or something like that.
No, it could have been really small. There seems to be very little computer generated images and...
Yeah.
I can't imagine that DiCaprio is worth that, that like putting such a big dent in your budget. Chase Infinity is a complete unknown.
Nolan made Oppenheimer for $30 million less, so and there's far
and
more.
And there was explosion in there.
There was an atomic bomb.
That's crazy. We hope it picks up. If we can do anything to help, please go see One Battle After Another, because it is worth your time. Maybe that's also worth your time. It's very long. Maybe that puts people off. Whereas I did hear, I read an article, no, I saw a TikTok about someone who was saying that Gen Z actually wants longer movies, because if you're going to spend $17 or something to go see a movie, you want it to not be 90 minutes and you want it to cover a whole like part of the day.
Yeah, but the last film that Leonardo DiCaprio was in that grossed over $300 million was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and that was also almost 3 hours.
What has he been in the meantime? Has he even been in anything since then?
I don't know. Forgettable.
Forgettable. Sorry, Leo. Another thing that people have been talking about this week is the Tilly Norwood drama.
Tell me about it.
For those who don't know, Tilly Norwood is a quote-unquote AI-generated actress. It makes me want to shoot the internet with a gun. I don't like any of this. But also, I don't like the discourse about it, as usual. I think it's interesting that we're going to be talking about Eddington, because it's very much exactly this thing that happens that, like, this Dutch lady, Eline van der Velde, created an AI-generated actress. And I think she did it as a bit. I think it was just kind of like, oh, what would happen? Like, kind of as a satire, or because she posted a video where it's like, hi, I'm Tilly Norwood. Then she's like, oh, I got my first acting gig, which is also just a thing that she AI-generated. Really, 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 really shitty. Sorry, Eline, if you're watching. I hate what you're doing. really shitty, like, pitch commercial about using AI actors.
Yeah.
And the headlines, because people love getting clicks, are AI actress takes Hollywood by storm, a bidding war ensues. Who's been bidding on this? Show me one person who's been bidding on this. I think that's just someone pulled that out of his ass. And now, like, I got a call from the radio yesterday. It's like, what do we do about this? Do we talk about this? And it's like, it just goes to show that I think we need rules and regulations for this shit. How does this make you feel?
Well, I agree with the rules and regulations, but I also just, people want to do that. Let them do that, because I think it's a waste of money, and I just can't see people
gonna who watches that. Like, I saw this incredible guy. I don't know his name right now. There was an incredible guy on TikTok who did a bit where he was like, are you excited about Tilly Norwood? I have some suggestions for you. Blocks. You can build your papa and mama's house. And like, maybe you can ask your papa and mama to jingle some keys at you.
Exactly.
That's what it is. Like, which dumb fuck would sit down and watch this? And Zuckerberg, equally scum of the earth, also came out with like, our new AI is going to be so good that everyone can generate clips of, and it's going to look great. Yeah. And it's like, okay, then who's going to watch it? Who's going to sit there and watch it?
But I think I was reading a bit about Aline, and so she set up an AI production company, so it just sounds like this is a money grab, but she was then trying to like justify that it's like a real creative piece of work, trying to direct this machine to give it the nuances and all this stuff. And I was just like, I was expecting to talk about how Dutch film is coming back or it's going to be put on the map, but I didn't expect this was what we were going to talk about.
Yeah, meanwhile, Dutch people are fucking shit up. Well. Shall we talk about something that I think will be a little bit more positive?
Yeah, talking about breaking the internet or wanting to shoot the internet with a gun. I think Eddington's a great place to dive into.
Absolutely. Eddington. It's May 2020 and COVID-19 has not yet hit the small American town of Eddington. However, the mayor, played by Pedro Pascal, is enacting pretty heavy COVID measures. Masks and social distancing and the whole shebang. This sets off the sheriff, played by Joaquin Phoenix. And what starts as a simple discussion about masks ends up splitting the town into two camps, fed by the 24-hour news cycle and social media algorithms. Here's a clip.
Can we just talk? Can we just the two of us?
We are.
Okay. So maybe I just talk to your video. Ask where all your deputies went.
Okay, well, why not just ask your governor about her little catch and release policy, okay? Because if it wasn't for that, maybe I could hold on to my deputies and the people we arrest.
I know one of them was fired for excessive force and another one was forced to quit by a YouTube First Amendment auditor.
Okay, yes, that is the same auditor that drove away your work.
Your undersheriff died of a fentanyl overdose.
From handling fentanyl.
And your captain and your chief deputy took jobs in Rio Rancho.
That was devastating.
You can't keep your own office going, but you're going to run mine. Leave your mess here and start a whole new one.
So what's interesting to me about this movie is that it opens on a frame that's a sign that says there's going to be a big AI data center coming to Eddington, which is an interesting start. And I wrote down, I was like, what does this mean? And then I think it became very evident what it means. Elliot, what did you make of Eddington?
I really loved Eddington. I think it's hilarious. I think what's really interesting is, so Ari Aster, we know him for his horror, for Midsommar and Hereditary. I don't normally like horrors, but he made them perfectly.
Elevated horror.
Exactly. And it's really interesting to see him, how he's moving away from horror, because he no longer sees it as perhaps a useful vehicle for expressing the horrors of reality, because they're already right there. And it's really cool to see him try and work out, or try to make sense of all these things that have come to light since COVID, of perhaps his reality being shattered, of all the people that have popped up within that, or the characters, and how we're sort of having a crisis of the individual self.
Yeah.
As our friend Hugo would say, it's a very demented film. I think parts of it, Ari Aster doesn't quite know himself the answers or what he's looking for. I think the ending is especially a bit like, I'm not sure. it's similar to One Battle After Another, the sense of these like liberal white male directors whose reality of the world have been completely shattered and they're having to come to sense with that. Mm-hmm. And they're fortunate that they're given a chance within Hollywood to make these films, because I think if they were black, if they were female, they perhaps wouldn't be given the budget or the scope to do so. Yeah. But I still am all for it, for them trying to perhaps wrestle with themselves and be like, huh, my liberal idea of what I thought worked and democratic institutions and freedom and the American dream don't add up anymore. So what can I say about this? And what about you?
I loved it.
Yeah.
And I was getting a little worried because, you know, several of my friends saw it at Cannes, and most people that I talked to were like, meh, you know, didn't love it. I was like, I usually love Ari Aster. I also loved Bo is Afraid, which is a ride, which is like 3.5 hours long or something, but I love that movie. And going into Eddington, it was so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because it's COVID feels very recent, which is also a lot of the things I'm very interested in reading negative reviews of this movie, because I was like, that's so ironic that the criticism that this movie gets is exactly what the movie is about. It's like, hey, you said something bad about our side too. You only should say things about the other side.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting to see that that was the criticism, but also that the criticism was like, well, we're still like in this. COVID is not far away enough to even reflect upon this. And I think it's exactly the movie that we need to be making right now, is like, hold up a mirror to what we are doing here. We all feel that something is fucked up in this world, except we can't figure out what it is. And we can't agree what it is. Then you have these tech companies that love to have your eyeballs on screen. So what they do is they feed into your ideas, whether they're right or wrong, which Ari Aster has also very much expressed. Like, it criticizes parts of the, it seems to criticize parts of the Black Lives Matter movement. But what it does is it criticizes the fact that these people are protesting in a 300-person town with two policemen, one black one one white one.
Yeah.
They're protesting this, they're screaming in the streets, and it doesn't even affect them there. And it's all because you're being fed these algorithms. This is what you're supposed to care about, and this is exactly how you should be caring about it.
Yeah.
And don't you dare talk to the other side about it.
Well, it also shows the performativity of it all, right? So the people that, I just found it hilarious, the Black Lives Matter protesters within the film are sort of asking this black cop, like,
you should be on our side,
as if explaining to him what oppression is and everything. And then you just see sort of, people don't even know what they're fighting for or what they're standing for. That, like you said, the algorithms are telling them at least, oh, you have to take a side because it matters. And for some of them even, oh, girls might like you more if you take a certain side in this.
Right. Yeah, because that's a little plot line where a guy wants to get noticed by a girl. So he starts kind of performatively showing up to these protests, and they protest for the unhoused. And there's a homeless man kind of like aimlessly walking through this protest.
Yeah.
Like kind of like blabbering to himself, and they don't even look at him, but they are protesting for the unhoused. Like, it's a lot of that. And, you know, I don't think it directly criticizes what it's protesting. It's criticizing the way.
Not at all. And I think Ari Aster, what I loved most about this is he is able to capture all the nuances of all these different characters and individuals that we see in reality, that we see in our day-to-day, that we see online. And I think he does very well not to judge them in any way, that he just presents them to us and we see how they interact with each other and whether their values hold up or not. But also,
I'd say the first half of the movie does that, and then it pretty heavily spirals out of control. But yeah, I felt in the build-up it was actually quite a realistic representation of how this would happen and how it has happened all around us.
Yeah.
Even within your home, his Joaquin Phoenix's wife is played by Emma Stone. Her mom is a conspiracy theorist who keeps watching this YouTube channel by Austin Butler, who's like a charismatic man with tattoos and an annoying haircut. And she kind of like spirals, and she listens to this man, and she kind of like falls for his charismatic persona and his ideas. So she becomes a conspiracy theorist, and it happens within your own home. We've all seen it happen in our own environment, where you might be at odds with your friends all of a sudden about how you consume media, or their algorithm's slightly different than yours. So now you disagree about certain things. Whereas in the before times, you also had left wing and right wing, except you just mingle more.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, hey, I disagree about this. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I see it this way because I come from this background where I had a couple bad experiences with this. And I really don't feel we do that anymore. We just shout at each other. One side is libtards, the other one's bigots, racists, sexists, Islamophobes. And we don't really have the nuances anymore. And the only ones who win are the big tech companies.
Yeah. And that, I also like the undertones of Austin Butler's character of weaponizing religion. Mm-hmm. I think that's also a big thing in America that doesn't get spoken about enough, of how like Christianity or these mega churches are using a way, it's a way for them to infiltrate people's mind and convince them that they're on the side of good.
Yeah.
And then also there is political violence within this film, which I think perfectly captures what we've seen recently in the last couple of months of mm-hmm. how people are turning to violent means for, without necessarily having like a clear reason for why they're committing it. And and like you said, in the end it's the big tech companies that win. So I watched it in the UK and I was the only one laughing in the cinema. It felt, like you said, almost taboo, like that mm-hmm. oh, we shouldn't be laughing at these people. But I think that's the whole point of what Ari Aster is trying to do. Instead of using horror, he's now using comedy to try and show the
horrors of real life.
Yeah, exactly. And the absurdity of it all.
Yeah, I think because a lot of people are just like pissed off about this movie. Even a lot of my friends are pissed off about this movie. And I think that just goes to show that media literacy or trust in a director, like also knowing a little bit who a director is, where he comes from. If you want to know a little bit more, you're listening to a great podcast right now, but there's a great podcast called Script Apart by a guy named Al Horner. He is the best. He asks amazing questions, and he has about 45 minutes with Ari Aster where goes into the full script, and Ari Aster just gives a lot of great context to this movie, just showing that, he is on our side, even though it shouldn't matter, and it doesn't matter. He is very much on our side, but he's criticizing the way we're having these discussions. I also think it's very interesting. Earlier, you mentioned One Battle After Another. These feel like companion pieces, but then One Battle After Another is like, oh, the world is fucked, but maybe the next generation's gonna fix it.
Yeah.
And this one is like, the world is fucked, and also the next generation
is fucked.
And we're idiots. And there's no hope because AI is gonna take over and make sure that we're all at odds with each other.
I also would recommend watching his Criterion Closet that he did for this film. He picks out all the films that inspired him for this. Really? And you'll see it's more about, there's a theme of individuals going crazy or losing their sanity within a state or within reality. And I think it sort of shows you of what he's trying to capture rather than it necessarily being political commentary in any way. And I think a refusal to get engaged with this film is sort of just a refusal to accept what's happening right now or to try and think about the nuances of why it's happening.
Yeah. Like, it can't be that half of the world are just evil bigots. Like, they got there, they arrived there in a way that makes sense if you look at how our media is set up, how we have a 24-hour news cycle that tells you everything that's wrong with the world all the time. It's beaming that into your eyeballs.
Yeah.
And these algorithms, I mean, you saw it in adolescence, for example, like all of these pieces of media that are now trying to warn us for the dangers of, you know, kind of like falling into your algorithm and thinking that's the only right way to live. Because it's very easy to do that.
Yeah. Maybe the final thing I say is, me personally, I think my politics are probably still a bit different to Ari Aster. I think he's a liberal. Sure. But I think it's good that people like him are having an awakening and trying to make sense of that, because that's, if he can do that, who else can do that? Even people further to the right can do that. And I think it's a good place to start. Without having these conversations, then we're going to be stuck in vicious cycles of algorithms.
Yeah, because he's a centrist white man. It's well, maybe we should all move a little bit more towards each other. Not that we all should be centrist. Like, please keep believing in your ideals and keep protesting and keep doing all of this. Mm-hmm. But if we kind of like X out anything that's a different idea than what we have, I think we're in a dangerous place in society.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we can probably move on to Ridland. But I think, again, there's a connection to this film as well that I'd like to dive into.
Ridland in Dutch, Reedland in English. The story centers around Johan, a reed cutter in the remote Dutch farmlands, who discovers a young girl's lifeless body in his field. Shocked and filled with a vague sense of guilt, he starts caring for his granddaughter while seeking answers. And as the police do not seem to be very helpful, Johan becomes obsessed with the case, trying to track down who in his small community could have been responsible for this. Here's a clip.
what I have earned.
Det är en trupp annan.
Kicken vill väl bli ut.
Vad sa trutters?
I saw yesterday as the closing film of the Nederlands Film Festival, the Dutch Film Festival. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah?
I thought it was really cool.
Could you maybe tell us a bit about why you thought it was?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm always really excited to see a Dutch filmmaker take a bit of a swing and have it not, first of all, thank you for not making a rom-com. That's a win. But also, it's a movie with so much stillness. It's visually stunning. Yeah. I think the most visually stunning Dutch film I have seen. It does this thing where I think for the first like 15 minutes, like two words are spoken.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be no dialogue.
Yeah. And it does it so beautifully. The actor is incredible.
He's a real...
Yes.
Reed
so
Carter.
Gerrit Knobbe, who now in his local town where this was recorded is called Gerrit Clooney, is an actual...
Really?
He was there yesterday. They did this whole talk. But like Gerrit Knobbe Clooney is an actual reed cutter. So this life that he lives in these fields cutting this reed is actually what he does for a living. So he could bring in all this like truth to it. But it's also incredible that they found this like random... man who is also just really great at being on camera, because yeah. I've worked with amateur, just like regular people before on camera. It's really hard to get someone to perform naturally in front of a camera, and I think all the actors in this movie aren't professional actors, and at no point do you feel that, yet you still feel it the whole time.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, these do feel like real people.
Yeah, if it has like a documentary feel to their performances. Yeah. Almost. But yeah, it's quite remarkable, actually, that because, like you said, there isn't much dialogue, then you really do have to perform in a certain mm-hmm. way, because you have yeah. to be conscious of how you're moving your body and the facial expressions. But I guess, and you also have, for the director Sven, you have to create sort of a comfort or safety for them to just act. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like you said, it's a slow burner, but it really builds. And I think what I loved about the story itself, it keeps, there's all these twists and turns that you don't necessarily expect. It keeps changing direction, which I like, but perhaps can sometimes be its flaw, because maybe it's trying to address too much at once.
Right.
But I'm still happy that he takes such a big swing. Visually, I don't know a lot about Dutch painting, but I know enough to know that this is inspired heavily by the
That's
Dutch
just
masters.
What our beautiful landscape yeah. looks like, Elliot. Welcome yeah, yeah. to our country.
There's that one shot with all the reeds, which is just gorgeous. It's quite funny. I was reading some of the Letterboxd comments about this film, and one that kept popping up was just like, this is a good film for a Scandinavian film.
See, that might be a Kermit and Mia reference, where they keep jokingly calling the Netherlands Scandinavia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I famously, not famously, nobody knows who I am, but like I don't watch trailers ever. And then recently I was in the cinema and it started and I was like, oh, I think that's that movie that we're going to be talking yeah. about on the podcast. Let me just kind of prep for what this is. The trailer oddly seems way more like A24, Robert Eggers-y kind of horror. Trailer makes it seem way more jarring. But all the elements are in there, but the movie just takes so much time that it also has this like hypnotic quality to it.
Yeah.
But it's also just very tasteful.
Yeah.
At some point, his granddaughter has to put on a school play. I am a sucker for that trope. Sorry. I love it. I love when there's a school play, because you can do like fun things with decor and costumes. And the costumes that they have are just so incredibly tasteful.
Yeah.
It just feels like someone who wanted to make something visually stunning and absolutely succeeded in making that. Also, the images of fire and...
Yeah, it's very elemental in that yeah. sense. The other thing I like is that... So you have all these kind of different subplots, but really sort of this overwhelming sense of eeriness. And I think, to me, it spoke most to sort of this powerlessness of how things are changing or happening around you and you're yeah. not able to act or respond to it in ways that can protect yourself or your family or people. And I think something that perhaps gets missed, perhaps within an international audience, is the farmers within that.
Yeah.
So for people that don't know, maybe you can explain a bit better, but there's sort of a a real divide between farmers and the rest of the country in the Netherlands, absolutely. If I can say that. And that's mainly because of sort of the modernization of technology and them sort of being left out, I think, and sort of, how do you say it, like...
They're like the market is just against them. Like China lowers their prices, so they have to lower their prices. He's someone who cuts reed by hand, and he's like, "Well, shouldn't you get a machine?" And he's like, "Well, if I do that for over in like 4 years, I won't have any reed to cut because it destroys the sediment."
And also because I think farmers traditionally work individually, but they're trying to buy them all out, and so sort of operate it more as like a business, like thing. And I think that is something I've yet to really see being captured on film, for them to be given some kind of voice or trying to understand how they feel like, and show again the nuances of these people, that they're not necessarily black or white, good or evil, but they exist in this in between, and also having to wrestle with themselves of like their own identity because it's being taken away from them.
And it is really easy as like the urban elite to just be like, ugh, these farmers and they're racist and they're this. And it's like, no, it's really complicated. You know, also, this is a completely different discussion, but I always feel like Eddington style, we always cut corners on these discussions, for example, and on our side of things, on like the green side of things, it's like, we should have less farms. It's not as simple as saying like, there should be less cattle, there should be less farm, because if we don't, the demand is still high, that will go to Poland, where animals are treated much worse, where like, so it's all of these things where we Eddington style are shouting these things, less farms, less this, less that, without considering the ripple effect that that would have through all these ecosystems and societies. And I think this movie very quietly, beautifully lets you into this man's life, makes you care for him. And I think that can open your eyes to what other people might be going through that you feel like you're opposing on a certain spectrum. And I think that brings a lot of humanity into this story.
Yeah.
There are indeed quite a lot of things that are going on. So you have the girl that was murdered. You have his own guilt. You have his own darkness that comes out. You have all of these things it's trying to do, but it kind of does it in a way which is very un-Dutch, because I really feel in anything, any popular Dutch media, whether it's music, whether it's film, it's like, here's what it is. You see it in Dutch music lyrics. It's like, I love you because you are my beautiful, like, it's a Monday and, you know, and it's not. So that's very much the Dutch way. It's like, doe maar normaal, dan doe je al gek genoeg, for the Dutchies. Acts normal, that is crazy enough. This is very straightforward. And it just does not do that at all. Yeah. It just really, because I was discussing it with my friend yesterday after the screening, I was like, what do you think this thing meant with the thing and the thing? And the and it just doesn't present you with the answers. Yeah. It lets you think about what that might mean and what the final shot might mean and what all these things might mean. I think this is a great first film for him. And I'm very excited to see what it does. It premiered in May at Cannes as part of the Critics Week. And it's our submission for the Oscars.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Amazing. I think hopefully we're going to be interviewing Sven, the director, in the next episode. But I really hope this is like, it opens the door for more filmmakers here in the Netherlands. I feel like, I don't know a lot about the industry, but the film funds don't take enough chances on such directors that are perhaps more art house or independent style film themed.
This also got a lot of funding from Belgium, actually.
Really?
Interestingly. Yeah.
And I think it's to trust these films that they will do well, maybe not be the same commercial successes as the rom-coms, but this, I think, helps.
This is something I want to say something about. My op, my op Johan Nijhuis this week said something in the Telegraaf, which is the worst newspaper. Not even worth lining your litter box with. And he said, like, it's ridiculous that these types of movies even get... He wasn't talking specifically about Hitlan, but, like, certain movies. He's like, well, this and this movie got this and this much subsidy, but only 3,000 people went to see it. That means it got 400 euros of subsidy per person that went to see it. He's a very commercial filmmaker. I say, fuck that.
Yeah.
Like, I say... Let's direct our anger to the Dutch audience for not widening their scope of trying to go see these movies. I think that's a very complicated issue. And I think these movies should get funding because they are beautiful.
Yeah.
And then look at these people trying to champion this shit once we get a nomination for the international feature Oscar or something. You know, it's always like so easy to say these things
afterwards,
but then never support people taking chances. And I think that's very damaging. And yeah. I think he can go fuck himself.
The only thing I'll add is, so obviously right now we see a crisis around the world of sort of nationality and like wanting to protect our own culture. But then if we're not willing to fund actual real culture,
then what do we get?
Yeah, what do you want to carry on celebrating? This Tilly Norwood?
Well, I know what you'll get is you'll get another movie with one of the five actresses that we have in this country where a lady from the city goes to a small town and meets a fucking guy in a plaid shirt who's carrying a Christmas tree and he teaches her the meaning of Christmas. That's what we're going to get. And that's the only thing we'll get if we don't keep funding and going to things like this.
Yeah, I just hope Johan Clooney doesn't get bought out and appears in these films.
Jesus Christ, who knows? Both of the movies we talked about are screening now at Lab 111. I think you know where to get your tickets. It's lab111.nl. Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab 111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.